Thanks for the kind words. I appreciate that. It's great to be down here in Auburn. It's my first time down here. It's inspiring to be among all these hardliners here. Might have a good influence on me to counteract living in Washington. Is that working? Can you hear it in the back? This has been a real good week for me. It's a lot of good things have happened. I got notice a couple days ago. Actually, I filed the application about 8 months ago, but I just heard on Wednesday that I've been approved by the INS and FAA to have flight training school down in Florida. And you know, I was a little bit worried about it because I was afraid if the FAA heard I was speaking at the Mises Institute that, you know, that they might consider me a terrorist risk. But I guess the FAA is not that well organized yet. You know, it's probably in the same category as the rest of the government. You know, I want to talk a little bit about freedom and terrorism and what the Bush administration is doing. It's fascinating to see how Bush is playing these themes and how almost all the media is buying into his rhetoric and his spiel. 2 weeks after the 9/11 attacks, George Bush announced that the terrorists have, quote, awoken a mighty nation that understands that freedom is under assault, a mighty nation that will not rest until those who think they can take freedom away from any citizen in the world are brought to justice. You know, from one point, that sounds very libertarian. Unfortunately, this is from a speech that Bush made to FBI agents at FBI headquarters. And it was a speech he made just after his Justice Department had proposed an anti-terrorism bill, which, among other things, would have canceled habeas corpus. But Bush keeps invoking freedom almost on a daily basis. It was one of the themes of his State of the Union address, and he's gotten away with it. Yet, since September 11th, the Bush administration has moved far along to turning America into a two-tier society, those who the law fails to bind and those who the law fails to protect. Thanks to the success of 19 terrorists, federal agents could have far more power over all Americans in perpetuity. The Bush's USA Patriot Act, the anti-terrorism bill rushed into law after the attack, is perhaps the biggest bait and switch in U.S. constitutional history. This is a law which treats every citizen as a suspected terrorist and every federal agent as a proven angel. But unfortunately, the vast majority of the new power the government has seized will do little or nothing to make Americans safer. I want to talk a few things about some of the different aspects of this Patriot Act. There's been a little bit of it in the press, but a lot of it's been it's been either soft-pedaled the criticism, or else it seems like they're getting their information from the Justice Department. But something we now have, thanks to this Patriot Act, is nationwide roving wiretaps. It's easy for the Justice Department to go in and get a warrant now and say that there's a suspect who might be using a telephone, you know, at Auburn or something like that. And voila, the feds can come in and get a wiretap on almost all those phones. If a suspect is using several phones in a Boston airport, for instance, the feds can put a wiretap on all the phones in the entire airport. There is no need to try and target the actual violator and perpetrator for surveillance. It's even worse with email, though. Thanks to this new law, the FBI's got a green light to vacuum up the nation's email. Congress, for the first time in this bill, officially approved and encouraged the FBI to use its carnivore email wiretapping system. I don't know how much y'all have heard about carnivore. It first came to light about, I think, in the summer of 2000, and it was kind of funny that the FBI would name a wiretapping program carnivore, you know. And there was a little controversy about that, and someone said, well, you know, but the reason that it had that name was the FBI thought people would never learn about its existence. So, I mean, that certainly explains it. But something that the Congress and Justice Department has done, it has changed the program's name. It's now something like DSL 5000 or something like that. You know, it's some nice arcane name that helps people sleep at night. But carnivore is contained in a black box that the FBI compels internet service providers to attach to monitor all the email their system handles. Though a carnivore cap might be imposed because of a single targeted client, the email is the software is such that it automatically intercepts all the email going through that ISP. And it's the standard for imposing that first wiretap is almost non-existent. The only thing an FBI agent has to do is certify to a judge that the information sought is, quote, relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. That's all he has to say, and then they automatically can install the carnivore and suck up everybody's email. Judges have no power on this. The judges must approve the wiretaps based on the federal agent's unsubstantiated assertions. It doesn't matter if the target is being the person is being targeted for trying to smuggle in a nuclear bomb, or if he's accused of dodging taxes $100 in his IRS form 1040. It doesn't matter if the citizen is guilty or innocent. It's putting wiretaps on automatic pilots and making wiretaps far more sweeping than they've ever been before. And there are other things that are compounding this damage. For instance, the Patriot Act makes it very easy to get permission to do sneak and peek searches now, in which the feds come in, FBI comes in, or other agents come in and do a secret search in your house and perhaps notify you a few days later that that they visited and perhaps give you a list of the things which they carried off. Perhaps not. I mean, and some of these search warrants can be gotten on an ex post facto basis. So it's really done wonders for the flexibility for federal agents. It certainly made their jobs easier. But there are other things which are just compounding these dangers level by level. For instance, something the FBI is doing now is doing much more often now. It's installing keystroke monitoring software on people's computers. This means that once this software is installed, that the FBI doesn't need to be there, it doesn't need to be within 5 miles, but the FBI can track every word you type, every letter you type. And this is a way to completely defeat things like pretty good privacy software or other encryption software, because the whole key to those is your password. And if the FBI can do a keystroke monitoring to find out what your password is, well, that certainly simplifies their job. Something else that the FBI is up to is something called Project Cyber Knight, which they're finishing up something called Magic Lantern, which is a computer virus which they're planning to insert into targeted computers. Now, the USA Patriot Act imposed very heavy sentences, even a life sentence, for computer hackers who go around making these kind of vicious software that goes out and destroys people's computers. But it doesn't apply to federal agents. So that's just one more example. And it's interesting, it's amazing there was so little criticism in the news media about the ominous aspects of this law, because the news media, most of the news media got their information from the Justice Department, and the Justice Department told them not to worry. But for instance, this is a law that the scope is so much broader than what people realize. People think, well, it's for terrorists, for the guys that walk around with the Palestinian headdress and have bombs under their shirts. No, it's not. I mean, okay, that's one group of terrorists, but the law is so much more expansive. For instance, the Act defines terrorism as activities involving acts dangerous to human life that, quote, may appear to be intended to influence the policy of a government by intimidation or coercion. This is different than what the government does. If the government uses intimidation or coercion, then it's public service, not terrorism. But this is a very expansive definition of terrorism. And there are a lot of groups that could be swept in under this this broad definition. For instance, and it would only take a few scuffles at a demonstration to have an entire group classified as terrorists. For instance, if there was a there's a lot of environmental extremists who have done some of them have actually been charged under existing terrorism statutes, but it'd be possible to classify large groups of them as terrorists. People were opposed to free trade or anti-abortion protesters. Now, and something which is especially ominous here is it'd be possible for the violence at a demonstration to be done by a government undercover agent. And it would still qualify that the entire group could be called terrorists because, well, there was violence at their demonstration. Doesn't matter, it was done by an FBI agent posing. This happened in the 1960s anti-war demonstrations again and again and again. The folks who were most violent often turn out to be the government agents. There's a history of this with the Ku Klux Klan as well. Now, but it's not only people who go to these kind of demonstrations. The law now is very strict on people who make donations to these kind of groups. Say if someone gave a donation to Greenpeace, to Operation Rescue, or the Gun Owners of America, and at some point the feds chose to reclassify those groups as terrorist entities. Certainly the Gun Owners of America should not be classified that way. They're a peaceful group. But it'd be possible for the feds to reclassify groups under that under those kind of categories and drop the hammer on them. Another, it could even happen to church groups. From the early 80s to the last several years, the Church of Scientology was engaged in a very tough fight with the Internal Revenue Service. The Internal Revenue Service had been very rough with them, and the Scientologists treated the IRS like the IRS treats everybody else. And it was kind of fun to watch on the sidelines. And finally, there was a settlement reached, and the IRS backed off of some of their harassment of the Scientologists. But with this law, it'd be far easier for the federal government to classify the Scientologists as a terrorist group simply because they had counter-pressured the government in response to the pressure that they had had. Now, a lot of people are thinking that, okay, well, this is bad, you know, the terrorists are bad people, and maybe it's a little bit expansive. What people don't realize is that most of the changes to the criminal code that were made by this act don't apply simply to terrorists. They apply to anybody who violates any of the 3,000 different federal crimes in the federal statute book. This is a law which has changed the concept of due process across the board for people charged with federal crimes. And it was rushed through with almost no hearings and almost no floor debate. There was a congressman from New York, Nadler, who's usually very bad on most issues, but he proposed an amendment saying that, okay, well, let's do this for the terrorists, but let's not make the law apply to everybody else, every other criminal defendant. But the GOT floor chairman, the Sensenbrenner, said, well, it's important to make it so expansive and broad because perhaps someone who starts out doing one crime might later turn into a terrorist. I mean, it's fascinating to see the kind of arguments that get respected in Washington. I mean, it's the kind of thing that sober people should be, you know, laughing, falling out of their chairs on. But, somebody says this on the floor of the House of Representatives, and the other congressmen say, well, yep, sounds good to me. Hey, Vern logic, you know? You see these guys, and I mean, my sense is that most people watching Congress are somewhat partially blinded by the idea of, these are congressmen. You know, but if you just think of them as average human beings just talking about what they don't know, I mean, then it's a very different thing. And especially with a bill like this, USA Patriot Act, this has profound impact on Americans' constitutional rights. It has decimated people's rights in a number of different areas, and my guess is that a number of provisions in this law will be struck down because they're unconstitutional. That's my hope. But it's, you know, congressmen take a solemn oath to obey the Constitution, and there were a number of Democrats who made good arguments against the bill, and the thing that came up again and again from the Grand Old Party Conservatives was that, well, but it's not our intention to violate the Constitution. It's not, you know, seriously, you know, they would say, but there is nothing in this bill that says it cancels the Fourth Amendment, which prohibits unreasonable search and seizure. It doesn't say that in the bill. Well, you know, since they hadn't read the bill, I guess it wouldn't matter. But, so this is a bill which changes how the government could treat people across the board, it could impact almost everything. In some ways much worse than what happened with the RICO acts and the asset forfeiture acts in the 70s and early 80s. People thought, okay, RICO is going to beat up the mafia. It's going to the asset forfeiture is going to shut down the drug dealers. Well, that's expand like a mushroom cloud, and now there's over 200 different federal crimes right now which the government can come in and confiscate your assets under the forfeiture acts, and most of them have nothing to do with drug policy. It's interesting how Bush has framed his holy war against terrorism, because that's what it's turning into. Bush has made a lot of statements that were very much in favor of liberty, but he made an early statement last October. Bush said that so long as anybody is terrorizing established governments, there needs to be a war. Now, this is a different standard than saying that you're going to try and stand up for liberty in every place all over the world. But just from his other actions, I'm kind of guessing that, as far as his personal conviction, that this statement is closer to his honest belief than the first one about his standing up for liberty every place. And it's interesting how the war on terrorism has lowered the barriers against the expansion of government power around the globe. There was a UN resolution shortly after 9/11 which encouraged governments to take anti-terrorism steps. And the UN's got a couple thousand pages of reports from governments around the world, which has bragged about what they've done to fight terrorism. For instance, the government of Cuba, as part of its war on terrorism, has added a new law that allows the death penalty for anyone who uses the internet to incite violence against the Cuban government. But it's even better in Zimbabwe. Zimbabwe's war on terrorism includes a proposal to make a crime to make any comment critical of President Robert Mugabe. And it's kind of funny to see what other governments brag about. Syria sent in a response to the UN and bragged that Syria does not give financial support to terrorists, and is sure of that because the entire banking system is controlled by the government. So there is no risk of money going to terrorists. But this is what the war on terrorism is. There was a statement by one of the top UN human rights officers. He said that in some countries, nonviolent activities have been considered as terrorism, and excessive measures have been taken to suppress or restrict individual rights, including the presumption of innocence, the right to a fair trial, freedom from torture, privacy rights, and the right to seek asylum. These are all part of the war on terrorism in various places around the country. And certainly our own USA Patriot Act is an example of the government going far too far. You know, Bush's rhetoric, he's trying to encourage people to think that terrorism is worse than almost anything else imaginable. That terrorism is the worst, is the arch sin of the universe. Unfortunately, governments around the world have committed far worse abuses than has the Al-Qaeda group or any other terrorist network. Mass murder was the most memorable achievement of governments in the 20th century. Some estimates governments killed over 170 million people in various ways. And by saying that terrorist attacks are the ultimate evil, the war on terrorism implicitly sanctifies whatever governments choose to do to fight terrorism. But in the long run, most people in this world have a lot more to fear from their own government than they do from foreign terrorists. But this has been completely forgotten. And Bush's comments on the on established governments, it's the kind of thing which you would think the White House would put out an official apology or correction. But instead, he just keeps going on making more and more statements, most of them not as extreme. But it's interesting with Bush how righteous he's been. I mean, it's almost has been a change in his face when he speaks in public since last September. I mean, there's so much more arrogance there. And Bush has proclaimed that there is a great moral and ideological divide. On the one side, the U.S. and other anti-terrorism governments. On the other side, the dredges of humanity who must be exterminated, basically. But it's funny to see how the U.S. government righteousness is a parody of recent history. Back in 1998, the State Department condemned the Kosovo Liberation Army for its terrorist actions. In 1999, the U.S. government relabeled them as freedom fighters to help support our bombing campaign against Serbia. And the Bush administration is still treating the KLA as if they were freedom fighters and not terrorists, in spite of all the Serbian churches they have blown up in the last 2 years since the U.S. intervened and gave them control. Bush got extremely angry about the terrorist who had mailed anthrax to U.S. government buildings. He cited that as one of the worst examples thinkable of terrorism. But if you think of what the U.S. government itself is doing in South America, we are fumigating a part of South America, the northern part. We're going in there. We have poisoned children. We have destroyed legal crops. We have just created great disruption, and we have helped feed a civil war that has that's resulted in tens of thousands of deaths. And that is chemical warfare as much as a few packets of anthrax mailed to U.S. government offices. Another example, Bush and the U.S. has talked about the Al-Qaeda, about them using jetliners as weapons, as an example of the apex of depravity. But for 15 years, the U.S. government supported Jonas Savimbi, who's a rebel leader in Angola, and one of his tactics was to shoot down civilian airliners. Okay, he didn't hijack them, you know, but still, this is a U.S. ally, and he's out there shooting down civilian airliners, and that's fine. Another example of the hypocrisy, of the double standard, and how Bush judges terrorism and how he judges governments, is U.S. foreign aid. The Bush has been very proud that his administration has shut down a number of these Muslim charities. And the standard for evidence, as far as I can tell, is that somebody somewhere has to have heard a rumor from 1994 or a little bit later, and that's practically it. And there is some of these cases, the government has presented no evidence. They have simply said, well, we have reason to suspect. And that's all that's necessary for the government to come in and freeze the assets or to seize them in some cases and just completely destroy the organization. President Bush was asked in a press conference, how much money going to one of these, being funneled to one of these terrorist groups is too much. Bush said that one dime of money into a terrorist activity is one dime too much. Bush also declared, those who do business with terror will do no business with the U.S. or anywhere else the U.S. can reach. But the U.S. government itself fails this one-dime test. If a person has any reasonable concept of terrorism and looks at who's doing the most to brutalize people, and it's third-world governments around the world, and the U.S. right now is giving more than $10 billion in foreign aid each year to these foreign governments. And foreign aid is aid from governments to governments for governments. I mean, almost all of it ends up being controlled by the politicians. So it doesn't make sense to say, well, but it was for a good cause. Well, it's too bad it went to the secret police, before it went to the school lunch program. But there's very little control of that. And if you look at some of the countries, the U.S., Bush wants to give $20 million to the government of Uzbekistan this year. Now, there's some nitpickers at Human Rights Watch. These nitpickers have complained that the Uzbek government officials have sought to enlighten dissidents with methods such as beating, an electric shock, temporary suffocation, hanging by the ankles or wrists, tearing out their fingernails, and punctures with sharp objects. And now this is all being underwritten by your tax dollars. And it's the same with our aid. We're sending troops and other aid to the government of Georgia right now. And as far as I can tell, from what I read, the government of Georgia now has an even worse human rights record than the state of Georgia had when Lester Maddox was governor. I mean, that's not an easy standard to reach, but the former communist henchman achieves that. And if you look at our foreign aid elsewhere, there's dozens of countries with very bad records. I mean, there's a flood of U.S. foreign aid going to Middle Eastern governments, Egypt, Israel, Palestinian Authority. They all have very bad human rights records. And it's almost like we're trying to balance out but it doesn't matter because it's there's this fantasy that we're building peace that way by helping underwrite governments throughout the region that have had horrific policies. Something else the U.S. is doing, the U.S. government is the largest funder of the World Bank. And we've been the largest funder of the World Bank for decades. And the World Bank will slop out money to almost any government willing to fill out a loan application. Thanks to that, the World Bank has bankrolled some of the worst atrocities of the last couple decades. The World Bank financed the forced resettlement of villagers in Tanzania, the slaughter and resettlement of Ethiopian farmers. They've paid for a lot of abuses out in Indonesia. Millions of people have had their lives uprooted and ruined thanks to the World Bank and thanks to the U.S. bankrolling of the World Bank. And yet, for some reason, we're not supposed to think about that when it comes to terrorism. It's almost as if the Bush administration wants people to think of terrorism as, well, it's not terrorism because the person was wearing a government uniform. But, you know, that is the ultimate black hole of the entire Bush approach to terrorism. You can't exempt governments and think you're going to have peace. But the it's funny seeing some of the Bush administration's comments on freedom because it's almost as if the Bush administration's affection for freedom is so intense that it cannot even be questioned without catastrophic consequences. Attorney General John Ashcroft told the Senate a couple months ago that those who scare peace-loving people with phantoms of lost liberty give ammo to America's enemies. One wonders if the Bush administration of freedom extends to anything beyond a right to buy an SUV. You know, because obviously, according to Ashcroft, free speech is no longer part of freedom. I mean, it makes me wonder if Ashcroft got his ideas from Lenin, who said that freedom was so precious it has to be rationed. For 6 months, the Bush administration has been pushing things like the USA Patriot Act and other anti-terrorism measures. These are going to be Pandora's boxes from which scandal after scandal arise in the coming years. Bush and Congress have acted as have given the American people laws and policies that make sense only if no one ever has a good reason to fear their own government. Unfortunately, terrorists are not the only bad guys in this world. Thanks. Yeah, sure.
Perpetrated the 9/11 atrocities were trained in Florida, where the president's brother Jeb is governor, and operated out of New Jersey, where his current EPA head, Christopher Todd Whitman, was at the time. So can we expect to see Jeb and Christy Todd Whitman in the gallows next to one another at some time, or a possible invasion of New Jersey and Florida?
Well, I think as far as the idea of bombing New Jersey, maybe it's not so bad. Florida not. No. This is a good example of the absurd of Bush making all these absolute statements. And the same with the city of Hamburg, Germany. There were a number of terrorists that were there for a while, and then came to the U.S. And the Ashcroft and some other Bush officials have tried to point fingers at Germany, but that's absurd because it was not a plot aimed at Germany. And my impression is there has been some cooperation between the governments. But there were so many incredible failings by the CIA, the FBI, the FAA, the INS, I mean, the whole alphabet agencies there. And it is amazing that the government now has more prestige than it did before 9/11. I mean, government has its biggest screw-up in history, and faith in government doubles in the public opinion polls. I mean, it almost makes me cynical. Yeah. Well, Magic Lantern, from what I've read, is a software program, which is basically a virus, which the FBI could use to send out to targeted users. There was some controversy with some of the, I believe it was Norton antivirus and McAfee. I think that there were some early indications that the antivirus producers would work with the government to avoid alerting people, but there was a huge firestorm over that. And the Norton and McAfee quickly clarified that, of course, they would not do that. But basically, what I know, and that's what I read from some Wired News and things like that. So, but I'm sorry. Yes.
What does it do, though?
Well, it would be a type of computer virus. It would act like other viruses. It would disable your your hard drive, basically, and paralyze your computer. There are some viruses which, once a person is hit, it transfers their own data to other places, forwards it on, which could be embarrassing. So. Well, yeah, that's a very good question. It was kind of curious. It was only a few days, I think less than a week, that the Justice Department gave to Congress this, like 150 or 200 page bill, you know, abracadabra. And it was 800. Okay, the final bill. Okay. I'm not sure how long the Justice Department's initial bill was, but it was full of provisions that the Justice Department had tried to get Congress to enact over the last 4 or 5 years during the Clinton administration and now under Bush. And it was like all these things were sitting on the shelf, and all of a sudden Congress, the Justice Department says, oh boy, there's a sale, you know, so, you know, let's, which is basically how Congress reacted. They said, okay, fine, good with us, you know. I mean, it was amazing how there were so few congressmen who took a stand, well, so few GOP congressmen. Ron Paul was very good. Butch Otter from Idaho, who I'd never heard of, gave a very nice speech on this. And there were a handful of Democrats that were good, but they're the same folks that are usually bad on most issues. But on civil liberties, the Democrats in the House tend to be better. And Russ Feingold, to his honor, was the only senator who stood up and said no to the Patriot Act. So. Editorially, the news coverage in both papers was not good prior to the bills being enacted. But what happened is that after Bush signed the bills, I think both papers started to have a little more analysis of what was in them. And they said, gee, this sounds bad. But for some reason, it really wasn't there. It wasn't there in force before the bills were signed. There were some good editorial columns. I think the New York Times is probably stronger. New York Times tends to be one of the best papers on civil liberties in the country, much better than the Washington Post. So conservative papers like the Washington Times were just, you know, totally pro-Bush. So, you know, totally gone. There's a number of different, that's a very good question. Well, first of all, I'm in favor of wiping out this terrorist network that did the attack. I mean, it was certainly a severe act of aggression, and my sense is the U.S. is entitled to go after that group and to put them out of business lock, stock, and barrel by practically any means necessary. It's a different question if you're talking about the Taliban, because the Taliban did not attack New York. The Taliban did not attack the Pentagon. So. But if the Taliban was working to protect the Al Qaeda network, they've put themselves at least to a degree in the crossfire. But the thing I'm concerned about is that there's a sentiment on there's a very false sense of security which is coming from all the BS in the airports. I mean, I was flying out of National Airport Thursday, and they were very they made a very big point that the no one can go to the bathroom in the first half hour of the flight after we leave, or else the fighter jets are going to come up and the air marshals will pull out their guns and the plane will be forced to land at the nearest airport, which has happened with some planes coming out of National because they have this idiot rule about, you know, that if someone gets up in the first half hour, they say, oh, my God, hijacking. No, it might be an old lady going to the bathroom. It doesn't matter. I mean, it's almost like they are trying to make it institutional to have hysterical responses. And you know, the thing that really aggravates me in this airport security, well, you know, someone, well, yeah, there's it's foolish how they're playing games in airport security. It's kind of PC games in one sense. But the biggest aggravation is they're hassling the heck out of everybody. And, you know, it's typical of the government to assume that, well, you know, people don't have anything to do with their lives. It's fine to make them go to the airport 2 hours ahead of a flight. You know, it's nice to be able to sit there and watch, listen to CNN news blaring. I mean, it's a complete waste of time. It's just pissing away people's lives. But it doesn't cost the government anything. So the government doesn't hesitate to impose these heavy costs. It's the same with the old East Bloc. It didn't cost the Soviets anything to have people stand in line for 3 hours for potatoes. And it's the same with, you know, all this time wasted for the airports. But the transportation secretary is very adamant that he does not want pilots to have guns. And guns by the pilots would be a much better, it would not be a panacea. And it's possible some pilots might misuse them. But it'd be a hell of a lot more effective than these gumbos at the airport. It's kind of like, you, okay, did somebody give you a bomb? No. Okay, next. I mean, this is what they're really asking. I mean, most of them are just kind of look like they, most of them look like they spent too many years in federal job training programs. That's the nicest way to put it. So.
I know it's hard to step back in the heat of everything that's going on, but we know that government has grown the biggest in crises, right? World War One, World War II. Could you give us some idea of maybe how we're going to be seeing this 10 or 20 years from now, assuming that it gets no worse?
Isn't that an assumption? Wow. Rose-colored glasses. Well, I think things will get worse.
Can you put it in context with the government growth of those other episodes, perhaps? I mean, is it as big as them?
Well, I think Robert Higgs might be able to do that better than I could, as far as he's got a better historical grasp on that. But, you know, this is only 6 months in.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's hard to tell where it's going to go. If there's another attack, it doesn't matter if it's going to be because of a government screw-up. I'm sure there'll be a new wave of laws, a new wave of confiscations, a new wave of decimating rights and liberties. So I don't know what's going to happen over the next 6 or 8 months. I guess it depends on whether or not people start to wake up. You know, whether people start saying, well, you know, it was the government that screwed up, and yet we've given the government all this new money and all this new power, and we have all these new people at the airport, but gee, the plane still got hijacked. That's curious. I mean, you know, it's challenging to try to find a way to break through the mental stupor of the average American. Because the average American is just, you know, there's a lot of very, very intelligent people out there that have put their brains on automatic pilot on this entire issue. And if something that can happen that will get maybe 10% of the population, or 15%, to start to use their natural intelligence on this, and start to just try to reason through some of the stuff, or to sit and compare some of Bush's statements, like his pledge to stand up and fight for liberty everywhere, at the same time he's promising to stand up for all established governments. You know, I mean, I guess I haven't given up hope that common sense could break out yet. So that's going to determine it, I think. Yep.
And I've read a number of other things by colleagues. Basically, every time there's a crisis, they want an expansion of the state. The press has been pretty much good. And yet, supposedly, the press is the firewall to help protect our liberties, expose government. Could you comment? Comment on this thing. Warren Brooks, the late Warren Brooks, once wrote in the Quill that
Yeah, well, it's been surprising that most of the press corps has jumped on the big government bandwagon, but it's been that way since about 1933, in many ways. Some journalists have done some excellent work on this. The LA Times, William Orem out there has done some excellent work. Some of the people that write for the front page of the Wall Street Journal have done some good work. And there's been some good stuff in the New York Times even. But by and large, it's just it's almost as if the critical faculties have been suspended. But it's not isolated to the war on terrorism. It's the same with the campaign finance reform. I mean, it's amazing that the most respected media outlets, print and broadcast both, have been so enthusiastic on a campaign finance reform bill, which just overtly tries to destroy the First Amendment and make it a federal crime to criticize congressmen 60 days before their reelection. You would think that fact might be mentioned a little more prominently in some of the news stories about this, the campaign finance laws, bills, but it isn't. I mean, it's just, but I, my sense was that for some of the Washington Press Corps, I think that some of them get a lot of their status from Washington per se, that they're, you know, it's almost like they're being a ambassador to another country or to the Vatican. I mean, and it's important that for some of them that Washington not be a total laughingstock, because that would undercut the prestige of their job. So but for many of them there's nothing devious about it. They're just they're left wing liberal. And they like big government, and they don't ask many questions. So,
but at the same time, they're always talking about civil liberties. Isn't it the state? I mean, to read the press, normal reporters seem to believe that private organizations are the big offenders against civil liberties, and government never violates civil liberties unless it's a quote conservative administration.
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly there's. I think that the Washington Press would be more likely to criticize, as time goes on, the Bush administration for civil liberties violations. I mean, it was amazing that the Washington media did very little on the Clinton administration's civil liberties records. Clinton had an incredibly bad civil liberties record, but he was just kind of the folks of the Washington Post, you know, tried to outdo Monica Lewinsky on the coverage. I mean, it was amazing. There was even a book by two Washington Post reporters. To their prominent reporters, something about the history of the Justice Department, a description of Maine Justice Department headquarters, and it was the subtitle was something about the men and women who helped save our liberties. And I was thinking, now wait a minute, okay, and this is after Waco. You know, I mean, but Waco never existed in Washington D.C. except for a tiny small number of folks. I mean, even the Washington think tanks almost never dealt with it until 7 or 8 years later. I mean, it was an issue that people just would not raise in polite society. And I think you're seeing the same mentality that it's too bad the government's going to be doing the wiretapping and the sneak and peek and all this stuff, but it's probably just going to be Arabs or Muslims or riffraff and not the kind of folks that go to dinner in Georgetown. So.
I wonder if you could
I've heard that. I don't know if it's accurate. It's very possible it could be accurate. But yeah, I was thinking about this earlier, and you know, a part of the reason the terrorists succeeded on 9/11 was because the FAA preaches that people should obey, should not resist. It was FAA doctrine that the pilots should just kind of okay, yes sir, okay, go and take over, and especially after what. We found out from the Philippines in 1995 and from other Arab terrorist groups talking about doing a French hijacking to plow into some place in Paris. The information was there that the terrorists were attempting to use planes as weapons. But the FAA never processed that, never mentioned it to the pilots, and it was still FAA policy that people were just kind of people were supposed to submit. So I mean that's horrendous.
Jim, I don't think the terrorists attacked the World Trade Center because they don't like our Republican form of government or the fact that many of us drive SUVs. I think they attacked us because they hate us. And I'm just wondering, is there anything the United States government could do to be a little less hated in the world?
There's a number of things. I mean, there's a number of people have, well, I guess it's Bush's doctrine that the terrorists attack the U.S. because they hate American freedom. No, seriously, I mean, this was the theme of his first speech to Congress, I believe it was September 20th. He was talking about that, and it's come up again, and it's something which even some libertarians have bought into. Okay, fine, thank you. Thank you for the clarification. It's certainly possible that some terrorist is very upset about the First Amendment. I don't think that's what's driving them, you know. There was a statement, I believe, that Osama bin Laden had made shortly, either before or shortly after 9/11, in which he listed three things which had upset him. He was very upset about the embargo on Iraq, which, according to some Arabs, I guess maybe perhaps the UN as well, has resulted in the death of over 500,000 Iraqi babies and children, because we have wrecked their economy a number of ways with the bombing. We prevent them from being able to rebuild. And, you know, some Arabs get angry about that. I mean, based on those assumptions. I mean, a second thing which upsets them is the U.S. military bases on Muslim holy lands. I mean, we have a number of bases in this Saudi Arabia and other areas that are very sacred to Muslims. I mean, some Americans might say, well, but it shouldn't be sacred to Muslims. That's not the question. I mean, my understanding was that the first Bush administration had promised that those bases would only be temporary during the Gulf War. However, we've stayed there forever. We're trying to stay there forever, and that's generated a great deal of animosity. The third thing that they've said was that the U.S. siding with Israel and the Palestinian on the fight with the Palestinians, and that's going to be something that's going to make a lot of Arabs very angry. So. Very good. Good. Good line. Well, something which has been funny is that Bush has been using this line about, well, we have to do this or else the terrorists will win. And it's almost become like an unconscious mental reflex. He was talking a couple weeks ago about expanding the Peace Corps. And he said, we have to do this kind of stuff to help send American values abroad or else the terrorists will win. And I'm thinking, okay, I don't recall Osama mentioning the Peace Corps. And I really don't think that the Peace Corps is going to be that much of a threat to anybody abroad, except for, I'll try to be polite. I'll try to keep this in a high tone. It's a struggle.
Come on.
Going once, going twice. Well, it wasn't going to war. It was the first resolution by Congress to authorize force. It was quite expansive, but yeah, okay.
Do you know what Ron Paul's vote on that was?
Paul voted in favor of it, and Paul put out a statement on that. It was a well-reasoned statement. I mean, it wasn't like he was double-crossing his principles or anything like that. I mean, he had a coherent explanation for supporting that resolution, which I thought made pretty good sense. I mean, it was kind of one would have liked to have a narrower resolution instead of making George Bush emperor or Caesar. I don't recall. I think I'm sure that would be on his website. It's certainly been shot out in mail. But Ron Paul has done some of the best criticism of the USA Patriot Act. He's done wonderful work as far as the impact on financial privacy, so-called money laundering, bank secrecy. Paul's got his staff is doing some very good work, and he's doing as much as anybody to hold the principled ground. Bob Barr has made some very good criticisms as well. He's a very sharp former federal attorney, but Barr voted for the Patriot Act, so that's kind of puzzling. So,
the congressional resolution that Paul voted for limited the use of force against those that can
conducted the attack.
Yeah, okay. That's a very good, yeah. That helps explain why Paul would support it. Thanks.
We seem to know a lot about one of the terrorists, Adam, and there seems to have also been kind of a blackout about some of the other Saudis. I'm just wondering what's your take on that? Why we don't know a lot, why the American press has been shut out of looking at some of the other terrorists?
Well, I think something that's even more of a mystery is why the press has been so darn docile. I mean, there have been door after door after door slammed in the press's face, and Ashcroft even has totally reinterpreted the Freedom of Information Act to greatly narrow the amount of information on any government agency that's going to be made public. And there's been a few little bleats in the media, but that's it. I don't know, but there are so many things that have not been made public, like I think the flight recorder and a lot of the information from the Flight 93. As well as some of the other the information on some of the hijacking situations. I mean, and I have not noticed the federal government to ever withhold information that made itself look good. And so I don't know what they're up to, but and it's certainly possible that foreign policy considerations are the reason for withholding the information from the Saudis. So.
I agree with about 99% of everything you said. I think you've done really well.
Thanks.
But I have a question about the embargo on Iraq. My understanding is that the situation in Iraq, as far as children starving and so forth, is very largely the fault of the regime, which is still using substantial sums of money to finance weapons development. I don't know if you disagree with that, and do you also believe that if we relax the embargo, wouldn't it be the case that then Hussein would have more funds?
Well, that's a good question. It's the whole policy of the embargo was to try and induce a lot of pain on the entire country by Iraq to help encourage the people there to overthrow the government. Well, it's been, what, 12 years? 10, 11, 12 years? It hasn't worked. And certainly, I think that the government is, I'm sure it's using some of the revenue it gets with the evil intent. Governments have a tendency to do that. But I also think that the humanitarian situation would be far better there if the UN embargo was not there. But part of what drives this, trying to understand the Arab and Muslim rage, is the perception out there that that these embargoes have resulted in that many fatalities. And it was something that Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was asked about, I believe, in 1996, and she had some quip comment about, well, you know, if that's the price of getting Saddam out of power, that's how it is, or something like that. I mean, Madeleine Albright did not challenge that. I think maybe someone here has done some writing on the question of the Iraq embargo. Anybody? Okay, well, I've seen some good writing on it. I've not investigated it myself, but I would be happy to see Saddam Hussein. It's always a tragedy if a tyrant dies a natural death. And if some Iraqi citizen wants to take out Saddam Hussein, fine. But I think it'd be a very bad idea for the U.S. to go in there and basically take responsibility of the situation, which is what we would do if we overthrow the government. It certainly worked out great in Haiti, Somalia, Bosnia, and Kosovo. Why not some more?
What does ACLU and Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International been saying about
The ACLU has done some great work. The ACLU was one of the best sources of information on this. They were very courageous. They had more courage than almost anybody else in Washington on the Patriot Act, except for some of the. They were way out there in front on the Patriot Act, and they've been a very good source of information. The president Nadine Strauss has given some very good speeches. Some of their policy folks have testified before Congress and really taken a hard line, so they've really upheld the flag. Amnesty, I believe, and Human Rights Watch have done a little bit of stuff that's good. They certainly haven't kowtowed, and it's possible that they've also done a lot of good stuff, but I'm just not aware of it. So.
Yeah.
Oh my.
Yeah.
Oh, very much, very much.
And yet, he seems to be on the same side as your paper and what you were saying. How can he be useful in this respect? Is he respected, and what's your opinion?
I don't know his work that well. I've read some of his comments on the post 9/11, and I think he's made some. I would agree with some of his criticisms. I'm not sure how. I would hesitate to.
He's not respected.
Okay, fine.
He's known to be a communist.
Well, okay. There are questions about his affiliations with the Communist Party, from Dr. Hamaway here. I mean, you know, he's someone who's been very good on some issues, but I guess there are some folks even, well, it's not something which I've looked into. I mean, I think other people here could comment more thoughtfully on that. Maybe Stromberg. Okay, good. Good to clarify that. And he's someone who's had great courage. I mean, Chomsky's been very courageous.
He is condemned by the establishment left.
By the establishment left, but...
the very same reason he's condemned by the establishment right.
But he...
way out.
Yeah. But he is someone who does get airtime. So...
less and less.
Maybe so. I haven't tracked him over the decades, so...
Yeah, I'd like you to imagine an alternative universe where on September 12th, George Bush had invited you into the Oval Office.
Ha! 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 This is a different universe, indeed.
Mr. Bobot, I know that you take a slightly different view about foreign policy than I do in general, but we have been attacked, and what would be your suggestions on how not to infringe upon American civil liberties, yet go about seeing that these bad guys get what they deserve?
Well, the first thing I would have done is, Bush likes to ask him, says he asks himself sometimes, what would Jesus do, you know? and it would have been interesting as far as asking after September 11th, what would Stalin do? and it would have been interesting to see the head of the FAA, the Transportation Department, a lot of these other federal agencies that screwed up massively and have responsibility for that screwed up so badly and made it easier for terrorists to succeed in killing thousands of Americans. Those people should have been held responsible. Those people should have been held very responsible. So I mean that's one thing I would have done. I mean a major part of the trouble is that the government is doing all these different things at this point. We've got over 2 million people in prison. We have all these different. We've made so many activities criminal. The thing I would suggest is to get rid of most of the criminal statute book, to concentrate on things that are actually violent crimes, threats, things or violent threats, and focus law enforcement resources. The federal government is already far too big. Part of the reason that it was so incompetent before 9/11 was that it was trying to track so many different things. There was a wonderful statement by the former head of the INS, Dora Meisner, I believe, Doris Meisner, I think that's how it's pronounced. She was asked about the some of these names being on watch lists, an INS watch list. And she shrugged and says, but we've got millions of names on those lists. Well, that's a problem. That's a problem, you know. Okay, you know, there's a very small number of people a very small number of people who are known to be involved with these extreme hardcore terrorist groups. And if you kind of mix their names in with 500,000 other people who might have underpaid their taxes in Belgium, you know, well, that's a problem. That's a real loss of priorities. I mean, the government's got to get its priorities right. And the government the government was created to protect rights and including people's personal safety, right to property, things like that. But the government has become far more concerned with controlling people than with protecting them. So I would just say that they need to completely change the focus of what the government does. Right, well, on the second point, that's not what I was saying.
I was
certainly not implying that ending U.S. foreign aid to Egypt, Israel, and the Palestinian Authority is going to create peace in the Middle East. I mean, that is something that the people there have to do. And it's a tragic situation. There's lots of good people on both sides of that conflict. Unfortunately, there's also a lot of, hardliners, I guess, who are driving policy on both sides to a certain degree. But I think it's a fantasy to think that the U.S. government can somehow crack the whip and make both sides all of a sudden love peace. I mean, it's hard for me to think of anything the U.S. government has even come close to achieving in the Middle East since 1978 when Sadat and Begin were in Camp David? I mean, basically, that's something that probably would have happened even without Camp David because the leader of Egypt wanted peace. And the Israeli leader also was willing to work for peace. And no amount of American money or military goods can substitute for that. So, anyhow.
In your view, how should the U.S. react to the prospect of weapons of mass destruction being developed by gangster regimes like Iraq?
Well, certainly a certain amount of... it certainly should be gathering information in various ways. Paying attention to it, but I mean, it seems that the Bush administration thinks that only U.S. allies should be allowed to have nuclear bombs, and that's the only sense which I can make of their moral doctrine, which they state with such fervor. But certainly, I think there's a lot of things the U.S. government could do to maybe keep an eye on what's happening. But you know, according to Scott Ritter, the former U.N. inspecting, one of the top inspectors there for the U.N., I mean, there wasn't that much evidence of them, of the Iraqis trying to develop weapons of mass destruction even before the U.S., before the U.N. guys were kicked out. So, it's a evil government. There are a lot of evil governments in the world, and I'd certainly keep an eye on them. But I think the chance of the Iraqis being able to threaten the U.S. with a nuclear bomb are very, very low.
But do nothing.
No. I'm saying keep a close eye on them.
You keep a close eye and you see they're doing it. What do you do?
Could you solve these problems right here?
Yeah. Right. Well, I'm sorry. I forgot to bring my magic wand. Well, I mean, that's something which would, that's a question that would come up if there was strong evidence. But, I mean, it's hard to hypothetical here. But I also think that even if the Iraqis had one or two or three such bombs, that they would not have a wish for national suicide. And I think both the U.S. and the, Saddam Hussein would know if he tried to attack the U.S. with a nuclear bomb, he'd get blown to pieces by the U.S., and if he tried to attack Israel with a nuclear bomb, the Israelis would blow him to pieces. So I really don't see, you know, if we're going to assume that there's a suicide wish there, then it's hard to make a rational response to that. So
I think our time is up.